Hey, America.
Start listening now. Can't be bothered. It's too hot out. It's June.
Yep.
We're in June now.
Yep.
Heavily into it.
We're reaching the point where we're beginning to have to chew our air when we go outside.
Mm-hmm.
It's thick with humidity.
It's Minnesota. The air is moist. It's also very hot. We were supposed to have the episode this week was actually supposed to be a rating the Eurovision Super Hunks, but that melted in the backseat of my car. So.
Ew.
The answer is Mons, Bonnie, and everyone else. Derek, roll it.
And welcome to the absolutely newest episode of 12 Points from America, Eurovision Song Contest podcast from America, a country that is thinking about things and I hope making them better. I'm Eric.
I'm Samantha.
I'm Danny.
And I'm Derek.
How y'all doing?
You know, it has been a couple weeks. Yeah.
Yep.
How about you guys?
One foot in front of the other.
I am doing fine. It looks as if things are slowly improving, which can't be said for every historical moment in America.
We're getting there. For those of you who don't know where we're all recording from, we are all based around the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul in Minnesota, which is seen sort of the core of what we hope to be a movement of making things better for all of our neighbors. That it's
where everything is happening right now, but not in like a hip, trendy way, but like... Yeah. Like a societal way.
Yeah. But we are all safe. We're all secure. We're all, you know, at home, putting one foot in front of the other and hopefully trying to make this world a little bit better. And we're glad that you're here listening to us. We really do appreciate you joining us. Feel free to follow us on social media, have a conversation. We would love to chat with you guys. You could find us on Twitter or Facebook at 12pointsUSA. Feel free to email us directly at 12pointsfromamerica@gmail.com or check out our website as well, 12pointsfromamerica.com. It's been a fortnight since we last recorded, but there's been a little bit of modest news in the Eurovision front.
A modest trickle. That's what I like to hear.
As opposed to the war garble of fire
one
hose
month
of,
ago.
No fire hose for us over the last couple of weeks, which has been nice. Although with the weather, I don't know.
I don't need a fire hose. I just a nice little sprinkler that I can put in my yard and run through.
An open fire hydrant, you know, just to run through. Like a street youth in the 40s.
A slip and slide. I can use a nice little slip and slide of Eurovision news just to hold me over until our next podcast a fortnight from now.
I feel like the only time we ever had a slip and slide when we were kids was like, we had a slip and slide that was like 15 feet long. So it was like, oh, great. And now I'm in the, you know, the vegetable patch. I feel like that was everyone's experience. I don't feel like anyone ever had like a 100-foot slip and slide.
did anyone ever have the like, idyllic slip and slide experience? I don't think so. If you have, let us know. 12.2.
We had a crazy daisy, but that's it.
Ooh.
Was it crazy?
Off.
Was really it like really up. Crazy?
It was nuts. It was absolutely bonker.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So what's in the slip and slide this week?
Slip and slide of news.
Yeah.
Honestly, right now my focus has been every Saturday afternoons in our time zone, evenings in the UK and the greater Europe, having Eurovision again to warm the cockles of my heart. We just watched 2018 this past weekend. The weekend before was the legend, the mythical Eurovision 1991 from Rome.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Which,
what a wonderful disaster that was. By the
way. Allora.
Speaking of that particular show, Sam, I told you this. For a while, my mother had been interested in visiting me for a bit and possibly while doing so watching one of these Eurovisions, because she watched 1974 when they did that one, when ABBA won. That was the year she graduated from high school. She was very excited to see that and kind of go back, and she wanted to see another one. And it just so happened that the weekend that we finally decided to do that was the weekend they did 1991. And so,
Oh God.
So my poor mom has seen 74 and 91.
she's still okay. You two are still talking.
Has she
seen Give Me Chance to Refine?
No, I don't think so. We played that on the radio.
So she's been exposed to it.
She's maybe heard it, but not seen it.
Wiped it from her memory.
Yeah. Those have been so great. And I was so excited to get 2018 in there because it's my favorite Eurovision. Just in terms of the overall quality of the music and everything, we've talked about this. Mm-hmm. I just love 2018. Speaking of which, Derek, what did you think of 2018 again?
It was a mess. Lackluster performances, poor staging.
Sounds like someone doesn't like Benjamin Ingrosso.
No, someone misses the LED. Somebody misses the LEDs. No, I loved 2018, but I hadn't actually seen it full since the actual night of the show itself, just because of geo-blocking. So it was really, really nice to be able to see that again. Yeah, so we don't know what next weekend will bring. That's something that his honor, Rob Holly, kind of keeps very close to the chest until the 15 minutes before the show itself. But we are incredibly grateful for the work that he does, as well as our dear, dear friend, Ellie Chalkley, who is the Jan Ole Sand of Eurovision again. So we love her very much. Literal friend of the show.
Yeah, I enjoy how much she is enjoying that role.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think we all would, but she has leaned into it in a fantastic way. So that's great.
Yeah, her fashion choices alone are always, always fantastic to watch.
We have, I don't know if we've mentioned, we have a date and a full title for the Eurovision movie.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm scared.
I'm terrified.
It's coming out in 3 weeks? 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Not even. Two and a half weeks.
2 weeks from the time that this episode is released.
Yeah, okay. June 26th, 2020. Get ready for Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga, starring as himself, Graham Norton. And that's not a joke. I can only imagine he's going to be like the British presenter. Like, he'll have to be. He'll have to.
Have you guys heard the teaser clip that they let out with the...
I actually just saw that they have, like, the song as featured in the movie, which is called Volcano Man, which, of course, because Will Ferrell's character is from Iceland, but...
Yep.
I have not listened to it yet. I'm excited to. I don't think we can throw to it because it's so brand spanking new, but...
Yeah. It's on it is on Spotify as a single, at least in the United States. It's on YouTube. You can find it. Brace yourselves. Hold on to your butts.
Without speaking to the quality of the song, I'm just going to say they know what they're doing.
I see.
Do they?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Do they?
I'm not saying that they know what they're doing and what they're doing is making a deliberately great song. I'm saying there's a particular sort of sound associated with Eurovision and they understand what it is.
Got it. Gotcha.
That's
they understand the sound that is associated with Eurovision. I don't know if they're understanding the sound that actually is Eurovision now.
Yes.
That's the problem.
This is the thing that comes up every year. There's always a song that the Eurovision fans hate because they always look at it and say, this is the song people point to when they say, oh, this is Eurovision. And it's not. It's what people think Eurovision is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, My Friend was an example of that.
But sometimes that works beautifully, as we saw with Spirit in the Sky. That for a lot of people, that was so Eurovision.
Yes, it was.
But it's also a good song.
It really was.
I will say this about this movie. It has it is branded as Eurovision Song Contest : The Story of Fire Saga, and it uses the full Eurovision logo. I can only imagine that our notions and predictions about this being sort of like the foot in the door to finally busting Eurovision into the American market. It seems like it's completely got the legitimate backing of the EU.
Oh, they embraced it.
This is coming for America.
I mean,
I hope they don't regret
open
that.
Claws.
The fact that Will Ferrell showed up at the opening ceremony party in Lisbon and was hobnobbing with the higher ups in the EBU, like they had the EBU's blessing on this.
I also didn't know Dan Stevens is in this to lend it some gravitas.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, which is the weirdest thing.
Yes. This is the killing of a sacred Eurovision Song Contest.
That part is not true, to be very clear.
No, it's
I don't know who the director is. I am 99% sure that it is not Yorgos Lanthimos.
I mean, take two guesses. It's David Dobkin. He's the director of Wedding Crashers. So, you know.
It's going to continue the downward trend of Will Ferrell movies in the last few years.
I don't know. We'll find out in about 2 weeks or so, I guess. Anyway, what else has been in our little bit of news recently? We had a familiar face show up on The Voice of Australia, which I was really pleasantly surprised to see. Johnny Manuel, who was formerly of Equinox, who represented Bulgaria in 2018, the contest that we just saw in Eurovision again, appeared on The Voice of Australia. And he got four turns from the chairs. Absolutely killer voice on that one, as he always has been. And he will be coached and mentored by fellow Eurovision alum from 2015, Guy Sebastian.
They can't stop, can they?
Nope. Nor should they. Johnny Manuel is an absolute talent and a great guy, and he deserves all good things. But I am also very biased because I got to work with him. So, yes,
Johnny. Well, he gets better gas mileage than Johnny Automatic.
If we weren't doing social distancing, Danny, I would have thrown something at your head right now.
Yeah, whenever we record in person again, we're going to have to put together like a 6 foot long.
I'm going to be in my own isolation booth, but it's for like my safety from like clubs.
Pillows being thrown at you from across the room.
Anyway, John Lundvik, our favorite disappointed face reaction meme, was on the Swedish version of Strictly Come Dancing, and he won it.
He won
because. Can you imagine if it was down to two people and they did like a side by side and he was both wearing and dressed exactly like he was at Eurovision 2019? And
you know, they went, sometimes you just gotta lean into it.
It is 490 points to Duncan Lawrence, and he's not even on Strictly Come Dancing. Just give it to him.
You know,
Kahani also.
Yeah. Oh.
In a classic German, what is this dance TV reality series that he was on?
I don't know. I didn't write this note in the script.
It's another dance. It is another dance competition series. I don't know how closely it mirrors the way Strictly works.
Is it, what is it? I don't know. Probably like...
Dancing mit der Stellen?
Do you think you can dance? I don't.
Something like that. But he finished third. I'm not sure who he lost to.
It's actually Let's Dance. Let's Dance is the name of the show.
I always find it really, really amusing when a country who doesn't use English as its national language defaults to an English language title for a show. Like, for example, Let's Dance in Germany. Or the program that Vincent Bueno was on, just Musical du Show.
Ah, Musical du Show, yes.
Yes,
it's a real shame that they didn't call it So You Think You Can Dance, because that's a great title of a show to just say in a German accent.
Oh, yeah.
Just imagine a German Bond villain in an eye patch leaning back in his judging chair and going, so, you think you dance? Dance then! And then he forces him to dance. It's great.
No, 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 dancing! Yeah. And that, my friends, was the Danny Popava accent of the week.
Mm-hmm. Good to be back.
Honestly, yeah. I knew that Luca Hani won, but that's just because he put like a very overt thirst pic on his Instagram to be like, guess who came in third? And he's, you know, shirtless, like you do when you finish third on a dance show. Hello, my name is Luca Hani. This is my Instagram. Get over it. Also, like, Alexander Rybak is doing something too. The man doesn't stop.
Well,
what happened?
Not exactly, Danny. Our good friend Alexander Rybak posted on his Instagram about a week ago about something that he has been struggling with for quite some time. This past January, he went into rehab for addiction to sleep medications, antidepressants, pills, that sort of thing. Pretty darn emotional post, and he's made some subsequent ones talking about music he's written that has helped him in his road to recovery, and just thanking people for support and things like that. But I wanted to give a quick shout out to him for talking about this stuff and being open about it, being vulnerable, which is something that not a lot of people do, you know. Mm-hmm. He noted that he has been addicted to pills of various types for about 11 years, and that's basically since he won the division.
Yeah.
So this has been a private battle for a long time, and so we just wanted to acknowledge. Good on you for getting help. Good on you for talking about it, being a voice for other people who may be struggling with this sort of thing. And best of luck as well to you, Alexander, as I'm sure you're listening to this show. But yeah, that was another thing we just wanted to mention really quick. And now that we've got all that seriousness out of the way, our topic of the week is, oh boy.
Yeah, we, with everything that is going on in our city, our state, our nation, our world, we really just wanted to touch on the fact that some of the most incredible voices and incredible moments through Eurovision throughout the years were given to us by some incredible Black artists. And we feel that they're often underrepresented in the contest. And we wanted to make sure that we honor the diversity of Eurovision. And we completely understand that we are a podcast made up of four white folks. And we are coming to this from a place of privilege. But as somebody with a voice and literally four microphones, we wanted to honor the contributions made from the incredibly diverse cast of characters that have come through Eurovision since 1956. Or really, I hate to say it, but really since 1966, really.
Yeah.
And how far we've come and how far we are still to go. We don't have the answers to how to make Eurovision as diverse and as reflective of the way society should be as a whole. But hopefully we can look back tonight or whenever you're listening to the show, and you could use the stuff that we've learned from the past to move forward and create a great contest there where everybody is welcome and where all are treated with the respect and with the fabulosity that they all deserve, because Eurovision is a party, and in a perfect world, all should feel welcome there. And that you kind of say that about life in general. And right now there are massive swaths of the people all around the world who are not feeling and not getting the respect and the love that they should have. So like I said, we're coming to this as four white folks sitting in our sofas trying to make sense of the world that is happening. But like we said before, we want to start a dialogue. If there is ever something that you at home are hearing from us that we can do better, we want to do better. This is a show for everyone. So feel free to reach out to us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, email, what have you. You know, we have the microphones, but we're doing this for the community as a whole. So be a part of it. We'd love to have you. Where should we start? Now that I've gotten my preamble out of the way.
So you mentioned it's not really since 1956. It's since 1966 or 64, perhaps, depending on...
Basically,
depends on where you want to actually put the starting line.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned 1964 because up until that contest, all of the singers, from what I can tell, you know, doing my historical research, it was a Lily White contest. It was a marshmallow. It was...
couple snowy marshmallow polar bears out there.
It really, really was. But it took until 1964 when a singer from the Netherlands by the name of Annika Grenle was the first non-white, non-Caucasian singer to perform for a nation at the contest. And she is Indonesian Dutch, so singing for the Netherlands. Of course, Indonesia being part of the former Dutch Empire, you know, you have a lot of that sort of colonialism coming through. But Annika mm-hmm. sang for her nation in 1964, a really very cute song. Didn't really make a massive, massive impact on the scoreboard that night, unfortunately, but it broke open the glass just a little bit. And it was really just the first inklings of, you know, there's an entire world of people out there that can be singing at your contest. So invite them all. But it was about 2 years later when we had the first black singers and performers making it to the contest. 10th in the running order was the first, you could say, performer, even though he wasn't actually singing. He was a featured soloist, but there was a flautist by the name of Sahib Shihab, who was the featured musical soloist for the Swedish song in 1966. Personal favorite of mine, Nika Mavals. So 10th in the running order. So technically he was first, but the first black singer who sang 16th in the running order in 1966 was the absolute legend, Millie Scott, singing for the Netherlands, the song Fernando and Filippo. High energy. She was dancing down the stairs in an incredible song and very, very modern by 1966 standards. And then knowing that she was the first black singer to sing for any country at Eurovision, it's sad that it took until 1966 for someone to come. But when Millie Scott made it to the stage, she knocked the door down, and she was really, really brilliant and very, very well loved. Actually, Derek, can we throw to a little clip of Fernando and Filippo?
Fernando, Fernando, guitarist at Santiago.
She couldn't even get all the way down the stairs.
She was like full on choreography, which for 66 was a big deal. Like, she started off stage and there was like a spiral staircase, and she sang like actually holding the mic, which was never done. And she like started by singing and like jumping down the stairs.
I see. At that point, if I'm remembering all the clips that I've seen on YouTube, it's a lot of just pretty gowns and standing around.
Exactly. But she was dynamic. She was moving. She was brilliant.
Difficult to have a gauge for this sort of thing, but especially because, you know, stuff about the song, we don't have the wealth of information and journalism surrounding the context that we do today, which is a glut of it. But I mean, at the time, Eurovision was only kind of political in the context of the Cold War, but did it have a political or social bent that, like, countries might have felt pressured, especially because of the civil rights movement in America concurrently, to sort of start including black artists around this time specifically, you know?
Certainly very possible. Like you said, I don't necessarily have that research at my fingertips. I mean, it'd be very interesting to know if some sort of academic study's been done on this, because I know there have been many academic papers about diversity at Eurovision. At that point, it was really seen as sort of a light entertainment show, that it didn't really have as much of the political underpinnings as it does now. You know, there was no Eastern Bloc of countries. I mean, really, Yugoslavia was the only one that really kind of showed up. at that era, but there wasn't any sort of East versus West thing or anything like that. It's really hard to tell. I know that at the time, Millie Scott alleges that her low placement on the contest may have been racially motivated, because at the time it was pure juries. Mm-hmm. And she came in, I think, third from the bottom in the scoreboard that year. But it could have also been her song was like nothing else that was being performed that year, and that people were used to, like you said, the pretty girl standing on stage with the pretty gown or the crooner.
Already had its established genre.
Yeah, and she kind of kicked that in the butt a little bit. And maybe some people weren't ready for it yet. I think her only points came from the United Kingdom and Ireland, which is nice to see, but it's hard to tell.
Mm-hmm. It's more interesting or surprising to me that Sweden is sort of getting in there in 1966 with the first official black performer, rather than the Netherlands. The Netherlands seems sort of natural to me because of their vast history of colonialism. It'd be the sort of thing where it's like France and England and the Netherlands I sort of think of as having, as being notably diverse polities when it comes to Europe. But Sweden seems kind of out there. Sweden seems an unlikely first.
Yeah, I don't exactly know how Sahib Shahab ended up working with the Swedish delegation that year. That would have been a really interesting fly on the wall. Mm-hmm. I know that he was a successful musician, I believe, originally in the U.S. So looking a little bit into Sahib Shahab's biography, he was born in Savannah, Georgia in 1925.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah, and was baritone and tenor saxophonist as well as a flautist. Went on to study the Boston Conservatory, one of the first jazz musicians to convert to Islam, played with Thelonious Monk.
What brought this man to Sweden?
Wow.
Well, according to Wikipedia, again, in 1959, he toured Europe with Quincy Jones after getting disillusioned with racial politics in the United States and ultimately settled in Scandinavia. He worked for Copenhagen Polytechnic and wrote scores for television, cinema, and theater. And in 1961, he joined a big band and remained a member of the band for the 12 years that it existed, married a Danish woman, raised a family in Europe, although he remained a conscious African-American still sensitive to racial issues. So he basically found himself falling in love with living in Scandinavia and becoming aware of the situation in the United States, and made his home in, it seems like, Copenhagen. But, you know, when you have somebody who's toured with Thelonious Monk and Dizzy Gillespie and Quincy Jones,
this man can go anywhere.
Yeah. It's like, what the heck? We've got this great flautist. Let's put him on Eurovision stage. And that's really, really cool.
That's amazing. That is a really cool story.
So yeah, that's that. When you take the time to really kind of research some of these folks, I mean, they're incredible stories. Like, I would not have known very much about Sahib Shahab until you kind of just dig a little deeper. And now I really want to listen to the song that he contributed on, Nu Gammal Vals, which again is just such a little bop. Derek, can we throw to that one just a couple little bits? Maybe his flute solo if you can, please.
So Millie Scott is not the only person over Eurovision's history to make accusations that votes were racially motivated. I dug up an article from the BBC back in 2012, noting that none other than Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Never heard of him.
You wish. Made such an accusation, talking about Jade Ewan, who was a performer for the UK in 2009. Now she had a good result. She finished fifth, I believe.
Yeah. Very good result.
On a song that Andrew Lloyd Webber co-wrote. He was on.
Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber. Get it right, or else you'll off with your head.
What is he going to do?
Do you really want to know?
Make a cat sequel.
Oh, God.
All right. When you put it that way, Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber was doing an interview a few years after this and basically said that he felt like racism played a part in where she finished. And he noted something that, honestly, I find quite horrifying. They were in Moscow for the contest in 2009, and he was asked at a press conference, why did you bring a black artist?
Really? I hadn't heard the story.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And
now I have to wonder the tone of that question. And I'm not going to defend this journalist, because this is a bullshit question anyway. we'll probably edit that. But I have to wonder if the tone was, and this is 2012, there's no excuse for this question.
No, there's no excuse.
If it was more, why did you bring a black artist, sort of encouraging of black artists, or if it was like, maybe like accusing the UK of virtue signaling by like being like, oh, why did you bring the black artists instead of like all the fantastic white artists that you
have? I mean, that is definitely the way that Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber, TM, interpreted it.
It seems the more likely one to me.
Yeah, his response was, according to him, because she is the most talented artist that we had, and I think she's a major, major star.
Yeah,
which is true. Jade Ewan is incredibly talented.
Yes. He went on to say, as long as we're talking about it.
Yes, good.
But wait, there's more.
He said, I think we would have come second, but there's a problem when you go further east.
Ooh.
Oh.
Throwing the gauntlet down.
Not one to completely stay out of the discrimination himself.
The sense of British exceptionalism does not die easy. Yes.
That's not very
there are, yes. Yeah. And there's more, by the way.
Should I keep going? Okay, so there's a step three here. Going? Okay.
Okay.
Yes, please.
If you're talking about Western Europe, Germany, fine. France, fine. Spain, fine. Greece, fine. Scandinavian countries, fine. Brace yourselves.
Oh, no.
But Ukraine? Not so good.
What does he mean by that?
I don't know.
Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber, who sits in the House of Lords.
Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber, you are doing so well.
I definitely wouldn't say those Western countries are fine.
No, I don't. Yes. I'm sure France in 1968 would have a couple of... You know, I'm sure France in 2016 would beg to differ. It's a very strange for him to be coming from a very imperialist perspective like this and dare to say that Western Europe can be any better than America or Eastern Europe in terms of discrimination or
right
ethnocentrism.
It is weird that this started as a defense of responding to a racially problematic question. Why are you bringing a black artist to him? Ultimately just being like, that really bothered me because they weren't racist in the way that benefits.
In the way that, in the good and fixable way. Oh, that's such a problem.
Anyway, and that's just one example. There have been calls. I definitely saw something kind of looking at stuff today that at least one journalist thought that John Lundvik's poor performance in the televote in 2019 was maybe because he was black. It seems like there's a lot of this a lot of years. I'm not saying
to insist on something like that is I say this as a white man in America, but it's too complex to ever be able to say yes or no, because A, there's the thing that we talk about all the time, which is a general disdain for Sweden's entrance, because Sweden is the juggernaut of Europe, because it's tough to root for someone who isn't the underdog. It's tough to root for the machine, like Sweden often seems. And B, there is a long history, and we should all be too familiar with this, but it is remiss of me not to mention it. The long history of sort of artistically fetishizing black music, soul music and gospel music and rock and roll music, and sort of misappropriating that from black artists, or enjoying black artists only for being artists and not for being like human beings or political beings. Like that's another long history that we can't get into. But it's just another piece in this complex puzzle. It's impossible to say, yes, he lost fairly, or no, it was because he's black. I feel like that's impossible to say. But I'm not saying no.
I mean, we can't necessarily look into the minds of all of the hundreds of thousands or millions, I don't know how many votes come into Eurovision every year, and survey people of why do you vote for person X and not person Y. But... I don't know. I mean, there might be certain places where a black artist might be treated by the local media as different than a white artist. But it should also be noted that he won his national final handily.
Oh, yeah.
That the Mamas the following year won the national final, not quite as, not as, you know, not a runaway, but certainly won.
So mm-hmm. The problem isn't Sweden.
You know, something else to keep in mind, John Lundvik did come in ninth place in the televote, which is still a really, really solid score. And I hope to think that if there is a small segment of the population that would deny somebody a vote at Eurovision because of their race, I like to think, hopefully, that there are more people who would vote for somebody just because the song is good, regardless of their race. And I'm almost wondering, hopefully, the people who are terribly racist aren't. You know, this is a problem with optics. Like, I almost worry that I'm lulling myself into a false sense of security of, oh, well, Eurovision is all about intercultural understanding and reaching out to our neighbors and sharing that. There can't possibly be a racist. No, Sam, of course there is. It's, don't be so Pollyanna-ish to realize that problems exist.
Like I said, there's a long history of people who have deplorably racist views and ranging all the way back to slightly prejudiced views, enjoying the music of Black people and anything else, and honestly enjoying Black artists, but just refusing to think about them as actual beings. You know, no, you're just music machine.
No, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, there's always that. I know you read this a lot, like the threat of the passively racist individuals, like those who would identify as not racist, but still harbor racist feelings. And they're not doing it consciously. It's all subconscious. Like they just, for whatever reason, would see a Black artist and just decide not to vote for them and justify
or use a, or use an entirely different set of criteria for evaluating performance.
Right. Move the goalposts for them.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder a bit if, and I this is not to say that the EBU has done a poor job of tackling certain societal issues and things like that. Not that it all falls on the EBU to begin with, since each country kind of does their own thing and then it comes together into this into this bigger thing. But when you think about how progressive and positive and supportive Eurovision is to the gay community.
Go on.
I wonder a bit if there are other communities that have maybe not gotten that same amount of love and support and positivity, and not even necessarily deliberately, but Eurovision being perceived as a progressive thing because of its support for the gay community, if maybe it gets, there are things it doesn't do as well that people just let slide.
Oh, yes, there's a long history of that as well. Yes, because we're good with the gays, that means we can't possibly be prejudiced.
Right, that's what I mean.
It seems, and I'm not making a generalization here, in a few very specific incidents, it seems like it's accepting of the gay white male more than others. And we've seen some problematic stuff come up about, like, lesbian performers, which was uncomfortable.
But. Or, I mean, Conchita.
Oh, yeah.
Mm, very true. It's a long way to go. We have a long, long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
But it's conversations like this that hopefully are helping chip some of that away.
So what are the things that the EBU itself actually, not like control, but what sort of, you know, how can the EBU improve this sort of climate? What can they do to aid, you know, exactly all the stuff that we're talking about?
I mean, that's a really tough question. Like, I'm really not sure. I don't think I have an answer for this. It's, you know, artist selection is done on a national basis, which the EBU really doesn't have any say in. It's just, you know, the networks say, let's say BBC, just to pull a name out of a hat. They say, this is our artist, this is our song, this is our presentation. The EBU goes like, okay, that's fine. They only really reject it if it's overtly political or falls afoul of the rules somehow, or it's plagiarized, or it's, you know, over 3 minutes or X, Y, or Z. They don't really necessarily have any say over who the artist is, as long as they are over a certain age and there aren't six of them and that they're all human. So, you know, the Vienna Chicken Choir does not count.
Yeah. I was actually just thinking in my mind if, like, the EBU, like, why doesn't the EBU kind of prioritize showing the ethnic and racial diversity of the countries that are actually the host countries? And then, of course, I remember, of course, that that's entirely the onus of the host country's broadcaster.
Exactly. Absolutely. And sometimes there will be countries that will say, oh, yes, let's celebrate diversity. And then they will have their show hosted by three white dudes.
Ukraine. So that was 2017,
That was
right?
2017, yeah.
I was taking a look at that one, and I'm pretty sure that there were three non-white performers at the Celebrate Diversity show. We had Isaiah, who is an Aboriginal Australian, and Yossi Papai from Romania, who is Romani.
Hungary,
sorry.
Yeah.
Hungary is Romani, my bad. And then the guy who sang with Valentina.
Who is J.D. Wilson.
Yeah.
Who is from Detroit.
And you're forgetting Chris Kostov. Yeah, half his mother's side of the family is Kazakh, and you could argue Asian, therefore, you know.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so multiracial, Caucasian, and Asian. So.
Well, okay, then four.
So four. So about one-tenth. Ugh.
And that's not the fault of the person who said our theme's going to be celebrate diversity.
Well, right. You know, they come up with, you know, the theme, and I feel like they were just like, God, wouldn't this be embarrassing if we didn't get a single black or person of color performer on my explore or right. celebrate diversity year? Yikes.
We can hold them accountable for a severe lack of diversity on like hosting and their like interval performers, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, they have no say in who shows up.
Who was celebrating diversity that year? What was 2017?
Kiev.
Yeah.
Kiev, that's right.
Kiev.
That's right. One of the Eastern countries.
Which, you know, I come back to an issue that happened up in 2012. The singer who was selected for Ukraine, an incredible singer by the name of Gaetana, sang a song called Be My Guest, won the jury for the national final handily, came in second place in the televote, but that was enough to get her the ticket to Baku that year. She was Congolese Ukrainian, you know, grew up primarily in Kiev, but also spent some time growing up in, I believe, the Republic of the Congo, not Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Right.
And when she was selected, you know, fans were thrilled. The song was this big party anthem. It was like it was perfectly in line with the mood of, they think they're hosting the European Soccer Championships that year. So it was that very sort of welcoming, be my guest, real awesome little party song. You can be But somebody from the Svoboda Party, which is a far right political party.
Yeah, that's basically like a Slavic nationalist party.
Yeah, basically criticized her and criticized the broadcaster for sending an artist that wasn't Ukrainian enough, even though she was born and primarily raised in Kiev.
Yeah.
Speaks Ukrainian, was selected by the Ukrainian people to represent Ukraine at an international festival. And evidently that wasn't good enough.
I feel like I read a quote that said something to the effect of should have sent something more European, which is despicable dog whistle.
It really is.
That's the thing that always gets under my skin about this. It's just like, why do you got to say stuff like more Ukrainian or more European? Why don't you stop being a coward and actually say what you mean?
Yeah. I mean, pretty clear what that guy's trying to say.
Yes.
Pretty clear which part of her, for lack of a better way of putting it, he wasn't happy with.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the song. It wasn't. We know what it is.
Yeah.
That guy, if you're listening to this show, you suck. Stop listening.
Stop listening now.
That's right.
But she handled herself with grace and strength and was fabulous. Like, I interviewed her and she was an awesome, awesome woman. A great voice. She came in 15th in the final overall in a pretty hard fought year. Ugh. And just, yeah.
She got that her whole life too. Like, there's this, you know, there's no way that one alt-righter tweeting at her was the first such sentiment of that she's encountered.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so she's lovely and deserves good things, and she deserves better than people from her own country saying that she's not enough to be who she is. Gaetana, if you're listening, good on you. You're awesome.
Tell me about presenters. Tell me how many presenters of color, or I mean, honestly, black presenters we've actually had. I, you know, am new to Eurovision relatively. I cannot think of a single one.
There have been a handful, mostly just recently. As far as I can tell, I think the first host that I could find just doing my research may have been Victor Laszlo, who hosted for Belgium in 1987.
Victor Laszlo, the hero of Casablanca?
Close enough.
Okay.
I mean, doing a little bit of looking into her biography, she's of a Grenadian Martinican descent, so she might be. I don't know how she defines herself. That's her choice to mm-hmm. label herself as she wishes to. But looking at family tree, it says Grenadian Martinican, so very possibly some Afro-Caribbean roots. That was in 1987. Fast forward a bit to 2010, we had Hadi Njie, who's Gambian Norwegian, hosting alongside Nadia Hasnawi, who is Norwegian Moroccan. So two-thirds of the hosting team in 2010. Fast forwarding a little bit further over to 2014. So out of the 3.5/4 hosts, depending on if you count Conchita in her green room duties as a full host or as a semi-host.
I'll count it.
All right, so out of the four hosts. So Arabella Kiesbauer has roots in Ghana and Austria, and Alice Tumler has some roots in Martinique as well. What's it with Martinique and sending people to Eurovision? I'm down with it. And we would have had Adzilia Rombly hosting in 2020. We don't know yet if she'll come back for 2021. I personally hope she does, because she is a force and a wonderful person. And Celia Rombley would have hosted this year. And she has roots in Aruba and Curacao, so the Dutch Caribbean.
And that's it.
From what I can tell, I mean, again, this is just on a cursory biographical hunt. Again, if we are incorrect, feel free to call us out on our social media. We're trying to get this right, but
yeah,
we can only do what we can. Mm-hmm. As far as I could tell, there have only been, in terms of winners, we've had Dave Benton, who's a Ruben, but is representing Estonia, winning in 2001. And Destiny Chukwuneyere, who won for Malta Junior Eurovision in 2015. And who knows what the future was going to hold for her if the 2020 contest went on. But we'll see her in 2021.
What if she just keeps coming back and then just like keeps winning? Like, what if she's like the Michael Phelps of Eurovision?
That'd be fine.
Or she just keeps coming back and just like every other competitor is just like, oh God, it's Destiny is coming back again. I thought she'd retire.
Retired at
All
19.
Hail Destiny.
Yeah.
Like I said, just give her the keys to the whole island. It's hers now.
Yeah. That's right.
That's fine. We talked about this. It's the Democratic Republic of Destiny.
So it really took until around 1994 songs and singers to really kind of address the sort of Black experience. We hadn't really had that before. And it really took until France's entry, Joël Ursule's White and Black Blues, to really kind of touch on the experience of being Black in a primarily Caucasian country. And it was a beautiful song. It actually ended up coming in second. The only problem is that I'm looking through the song and I'm looking at the lyrics and I'm realizing this was written by Serge Gainsbourg, a white dude. And I'm like, oh, come on. And I feel like now there's more of a focus on the singer-songwriter. It's not entirely so, but we're getting a lot more of that singer-songwriter vibe. And I'm hoping to see more people telling their own stories. That's something I would really, really love to see in the future. A song like that, which brought in a lot of Afro-Caribbean sort of musical motifs, was great, and it brought things to a consciousness and at a level that Eurovision hadn't really seen very much before. But to me, the entire thing is just tempered by the fact that it was written by a white dude. Like, it's thank you for telling the story, but it's not quite your story to tell.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that would fly today.
Could win an Academy
Award. No, I think there was a lot. Well, I was actually going to compare that. I'm like, yeah, it's like finding out that Green Book won Best Picture, but also written by a really white team. From what I can tell about Serge Gainsbourg, at least I can see that he was very sort of steeped later in his career into the rock, funk, and reggae scenes, and that he worked a lot with Black artists. But it still seems weird that, you know... Still couldn't get out of the way to actually let it be written by a Black person.
So his is the only songwriting credit?
I have to double check that, but okay. Serge Gainsbourg and Georges Ognier de Mossat. And another thing about the song, not only was it written by two white songwriters, the song was originally called Black Lolita Blues, which to me also not just brings up the sort of exoticization.
It's just strange. It's different
strange.
Because, like I said, from Serge Gainsbourg, he was always a friend of controversy from the looks of it. It seems like he was always a provocateur.
That was very much his shtick, yeah. Which is not to say that singing about the Black experience is shtick.
No.
It seems, I hope, anyway, that the intentions are pure here. Mm-hmm. But it's still weird. Still a little bit weird.
Yeah. It's like I said, I don't think it would fly today.
No, I don't think
so. Not so much.
If it flew or attempted to fly, there would be a lot of questions that would have to be lobbed at them constantly.
Oh, like I said, Green Book won Best Picture. So there's still a massive segment of society in the Western world that just frankly doesn't mind.
Yeah, because a lot of people will take something at face value, not look deeper into it and think about the ramifications of where this is coming from, who is presenting it, how is it being presented, and what does that mean for the person who is sort of at the face of it. And in a case like White and Black Blues, it sort of gives me almost like a marionette feeling, which I think is unfair to the artist. That maybe even at the time in 1990, it was seen as more okay to speak for the Black community when you're not.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said before, that cannot fly anymore. So we have gotten better at it over the last over the last couple decades, really. Like we were saying, the more focus on singer-songwriting, you're seeing introspective songs like, for example, Grow from Jungle McCroy coming in, which isn't necessarily about the Black experience, but just a human experience, and he just happens to be Black.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to a certain extent, K-Mama was about a Black experience growing up in the Czech Republic. And he, during his interview, he even talked about, like, people would attack him and his mother when they were just out walking on the street. That's not rough. Attack him, but, you know, like, insult him or threaten him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
He said something interesting talking about that song, and the interviewer asked him, this is about your experiences with racism. And he said something to the effect of, that's what it's about and what it's inspired by for me. But I encourage whoever's listening to take from it something else if they need to. If it is interpreted another way, he was fine with that, which is an interesting approach to how your own art is perceived.
I appreciate that.
Definitely. There are certainly a lot of artists, Eurovision or otherwise, that would be like, no, it's about this thing that I meant it to be about. And you're all wrong.
And then there are some songs that are just face value that, no, this is a song about falling in love.
Unfortunately, it's the 21st century. There's such a thing as death of the author. In my mind, you know, in this concrete jungle, it was not easy to grow up.
So, I mean, do we think that they're getting better from what we're seeing at Eurovision? I mean, we would have had 7 Black artists on the roster for the 2020 contest, many of whom we will see next year. As of right now, we will see Destiny, we will see Benny Cristo, we will see Eden Alene from Israel, we will see Jungle McCroy, we'll see Senit.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah, so, I mean, so far...
Cindy, tell us what to do. I think, I think that the world has changed in some ways in regards to these sorts of issues over the last couple of years, and people are thinking about these things more, and that is reflected in the fields we've seen and the commentary that we've gotten on diversity in Eurovision and so forth. It hasn't been a perfectly smooth road. We've neglected to discuss our favorite outlaw.
Oh, that's right.
Minor.
Good. Yeah, listen, I've never subscribed to the Whig theory of history. I've never said that it's all been a straight line of progress from, you know, year zero to now. But I think if we can look in, if we could quantitate Black representation and Black wins, Black artists at the contest, I think the past 10 years has been much kinder to our brothers and sisters of color than it has in the past. Oh, boy.
Yeah, but we still have far to go, as we've seen with just 2 years ago, what we saw with the presentation from the Netherlands. Ironically, the country that brought us our first artists of color.
Oh, I know.
Yes, has also brought us, you know, tell us about our friend Eric.
So if you haven't seen it, Waylon's performance in 2018 was basically him surrounded by a band of Black musicians, which is not in and of itself problematic. And
That's not the problem.
No.
The problem came in the way that he interacted with them and just the way it was presented. There was a tinge of superiority on Waylon's part to the rest. In some cases, physically, like he's on a higher platform than some of them, or he's pointing at them and they dance, that sort of a thing. And Sam, we were talking about this when watching this performance on Eurovision again. And again, the part of me that is idealistic and wants to believe the best in people and that sort of thing, wanted to say that I don't know that this was done maliciously to be like, we're going to do this thing and be racist. However, the whole thing is just so tone deaf to how problematic it is. It just feels like...
Well, the thing about something like that is it's unusual and unnecessary.
Yeah, I think the thing that got to me about the whole presentation was when the press and when people were approaching the delegation and Waylon saying, this could be seen as problematic. You might want to reexamine the way that you're presenting this. This could be an issue. For the love of God, consider doing something different. Instead of stepping back and saying, what are people talking about? Let's see things from another angle. How could this be perceived, especially for an international audience? And rather than saying, you know what, you're right, I hadn't seen things that way, let's modify this, let's make this better, they double down and they sort of attacked those who were trying to critique and improve the issues in the performance that they saw.
It's always that classic, you know, they hide behind the veil of, you know, I'm an artist, I should be able to be in complete control of my art form and I don't have to have foot like that. I'm like, well, I mean, that is completely right, but you do that at your own risk of alienating the very people that you're trying to get as fans. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And it's a shame because the song itself was fine, but the...
I hated that song. I can't hate that song enough.
Dude, but it's indicated in your hate for that song now.
Gosh, more reasons to hate it. Yeah,
now I can't look at the song without, you know, without cringing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because rather than taking, because right now we are all trying to take information that is either new to us or refreshed to us, that we're kind of seeing through new eyes, and it's on us as an individual to look at information that we are either seeing for the first time or seeing with fresh eyes and say, how do I take this information and change my actions to make things better mm-hmm. for my community, for my neighbor, for my country, for my city, for my world? And to willingly deny that.
Mm-hmm. In the past two weeks,
I've actually gotten angrier at Waylon.
Yeah.
Knowing,
oh, no. Does he have problematic tweets? Like, does he?
No. Not through anything that he's. I don't follow him on Twitter, and it's probably best for my own mental health. You know, I don't know what he's been saying. I don't know if he has been saying anything. But witnessing what we've been witnessing in our backyards, and then watching Eurovision again, which had the 2018 performance of Outlaw
Yeah,
AM,
yeah.
I'm now seeing this again. I'm like, no, no. Fala, hell no.
This is the sort of thing that I feel makes institutional racism so prevalent and so difficult to address at times, is that you will have things like this where the people behind them just aren't thinking about it. They don't think about how these things might look and how these would be interpreted, why certain statements or certain actions or performances could be problematic. And then when they're confronted about that sort of thing, they continue to refuse to look at it from a different perspective. They get defensive, say you don't understand.
That's what hangs me up so much about it, is his reaction. It's fine to be able to stage something like that. And I want to give him the benefit of the doubt and be like, he didn't have any feeling like this was being colonialist or like paternalist or anything. But to be, you know, approached and told that there are some problems here, there are problems with optics, whether they were intended or no, for him to react and go, no, you're the racist. I feel like either we caught him at a bad moment, or more likely, there's a certain amount of prejudice there that he just doesn't want to deal with. I'm not sure. I'm not accusing Wade of anything. But it's to react in that way is telling. That much is true.
Right. Mm-hmm. So where do we go from here? What do we as a community, as a fandom?
As a largely white community as well.
Yeah, let's be honest. Yeah. What do we do?
Listen, ultimately.
Yeah.
It's really all we can do. We can't be prescriptive in our from where we're coming from because we don't really appreciate the problem.
We can try to sympathize. We could try to understand, but we're not walking in the shoes of the people who are really feeling the brunt of these issues and have been for generations. So we need to listen to those who are experiencing this. And I don't just mean, you know, putting on a Drake album or, you know, listening to K-Mama like 85 times. Like, listen to people's experiences and their stories. You know, look behind, you know, dig into lyrics, you know, read poetry, read essays. And there's so much discourse and information coming out. Just take a moment and open your eyes. And even in our little Eurovision bubble, like, I think of a piece that Ellie Chalkley, who aforementioned, she of the brilliant, you know, working with Eurovision again and with ESC Insight. Ellie, we love you. She did a great piece on a song called Black Square that was in the Ukrainian national final this year by a group called Faux Show. That it was a great song, like awesome beat, you know, totally get into it. But if you take a second to dig into the message and find out what are they actually singing about, and it is them telling their own stories, their experiences growing up Black in Kiev, as well as mixed in with the, there was basically an art history course in a 3-minute song as well.
It is your fault. Well, if it's in the museum, then it must be gold, right? I guess I just saw my type of art. Dude from Kiev, Kazimir is number one in my chart, yeah. I'm just like a black square, yeah.
I highly, highly recommend you scope out that article and articles like it. One of you guys found a bit more of a tangible thing that we can kind of chip into, something about a Duncan Lawrence concert.
Yeah. So on the 18th,
June 18th, Duncan Lawrence is doing an online show with a full band, and 50% of the proceeds of that event are going to Black Lives Matter organizations, which is really great. In addition to listening, which Derek is right, that's really what we should be doing. If there are voices that we can amplify and organizations we can support so that more people can listen and we can, as a society, get a better understanding of where these problems come from, we should be encouraging artists to do that, to contribute to that. And it sounds like our boy, Duncan Lawrence, is going to be doing just that. So if you are free on the 18th, check out his social media. I'm not going to pretend like I know the exact details of this show, except that it's on the 18th and that it is for an incredibly important cause. So check that out if you can.
Yep.
Plus, it's got Duncan Lawrence.
Who? Yay.
That's some white guy. So.
Like I said before, earlier in the show, we are coming to this as four white folks coming in from a place of privilege, safely at home. We don't have the answers here. We don't even have the start of the answers. We're just trying to provide a little bit of historical information, some context, and maybe some discussion. Maybe you at home were thinking about something. Let us know what you're thinking about. Let us know if anything that we said tonight either touched a nerve, good or bad.
Mm-hmm. There is literally not a better time to tweet us and email us.
Exactly. Exactly. Except for maybe like 2 a.m. We're probably just going to be asleep.
Yeah, but, you know. 3 a.m. Yeah.
Yeah, just wait a couple hours. Somebody will be awake eventually. We'll get to it.
If it is breakfast time in Europe, that is not a good time for us.
Some of us might still be awake.
No, I am not. If I'm awake, I'm watching YouTube.
Fair enough. And you don't tweet anyway. Danny's not on Twitter.
No, I don't.
But again, you can reach us on social media, Facebook or Twitter at 12pointsUSA. You can email us directly at 12pointsfromamerica@gmail.com. Our website, again, is 12pointsfromamerica.com. If you're finding us on your podcast broadcaster of choice, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, I don't know what other things you're listening to. If it's giving you a chance to give us a rating, we would love it if you could. Ideally a good one. Give us some feedback. We're happy to hear it. And spread the message. If you've been liking our podcast, we're not going to hit you up for money. Not yet. No Patreons yet. No coffees or anything like that. But tell a friend. Share us with somebody. Get our voices out there. Especially for an episode like this where we have a platform and we want to share. We want to learn. We want to grow. Hopefully you do too. And we're really appreciative that you're there with us. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm rambling, guys.
I thought you were Sam.
Oh, really?
Thanks, Dad. I'm bringing it back. Until next time, I'm Danny.
I'm Derek.
I'm Samantha.
And I'm Eric.
And America, stop listening now.
But really, keep listening. Thank you.
Hooray.
All right. Okay. Zelda.
Zelda. Wow.
I can't right now. All right, you know what? Come on. Let's play Get Locked Out of the Bedroom. It's fun. You won. Okay.
Please say that we got that.
Oh, yeah.